Gun chest uncut, yeah, you know that's us. Where we only speak the real and the real rock with us. Where we motivate the people and politic on success. Oh no, we ain't DJ Kelly, but they swearin' we the best. Gun chest uncut, gun chest uncut, gun chest uncut.
What's happening? It's Contrast Uncut. It's season 4, episode 14. Man, big shout outs to Uncle Snoop's Army and Bobby D Presents. I appreciate you, brothers. It's your host, Zylo, aka DJ Juan Dollars, like I won some money. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we have an incredibly dope and gifted special guest. She's from Miami Beach, Florida, and currently based out of LA, you know, Los Angeles, California. She's a daughter of the greatest, Muhammad Ali, and the third youngest of 9. She's an author, realtor, philanthropist, and writer that has written some phenomenal books, leaving an in-depth level of understanding of one of the greatest men of our planet, her father. She has written At Home with Muhammad Ali, A Memoirs of Love, Loss, and Forgiveness, More Than a Hero, and co-authored with her father, The Soul of a Butterfly. She is also a freelance writer for CNN.com, ESPN, and Citizens of Humanity magazine. She has appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show, Entertainment Tonight, Queen Latifah Show, just to name a few. As well as, you know, she's been in the documentaries, including Muhammad Ali Through the Eyes of the World. She's also popped by here today on Contrast Uncut. She grew up with the champ and the greatest to everyone, but to her, it was just her father, and she was daddy's little girl, and that's most important. And if you don't know who's on the show by now, it's all good. We got the opportunity and just the blessing of having Hannah Ali, everybody. How are you doing, Hannah?
Well, thank you. I love that intro. That was just so gracious and nice. I was like, ooh, listening to you about myself. Thank you. Let me just say one thing. So I'm not from Miami Beach. It has misinformation online. I noticed that. They mixed my husband's birthday with mine and my other sister's location. Layla was born in Miami Beach, Florida. I was born in Michigan, but we were both raised here in LA. So, I noticed that a lot of those online profiles have a lot of, I think because there's so many kids, they mix the details up. So,
I'm from LA. Anything wrong, but I appreciate you.
Just so they know, people know. But yeah, so yeah, the internet is crazy. So, but thanks for the intro. That was really well.
Oh, Hannah, what part of Michigan were you born in?
So I was born in Berrien Springs, Michigan. Springs, Michigan. My father had a training camp. Well, he had a farmland there, 88 acres. He kept it his entire life. He loved it. And it was a couple hours outside of Chicago. So he'd go there to train sometimes when he wasn't at Fighter's Heaven in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania. And we would spend summers there with him after our parents divorced. And he'd bring all his kids together there. And he loved it, the beauty, the land, the peace. But it's a small little town, and that's where I was born. And I lived there in Chicago until I was about 2 or 3. And then we moved to Los Angeles, and I've been here ever since. I actually went back to Michigan to live with my father and be there with him for about 5 or 6 years. But that wasn't my adult years. That's where we wrote one of our books together, The Soul of a Butterfly. It was done there in that time that I was with him there. Best time of my life. So grateful for it. It was like from 2001 to 2007-ish, 2006. So yeah,
amazing. I have my family's from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and so when I heard Michigan, I was like, "Ooh, that sounds like we may have something in common."
But yeah, I know Grand Rapids. I had a friend that used to live out there, and he loved it. I went down there for a bit. It's nice, and it's a lot more popping than Berrien Springs, as you probably know.
Yes. I mean, I don't know. I haven't been across Grand Springs, but it's somewhere I'm going to have to add on the travel guide to make sure I see if it's boring or if it's to the hype.
It's not. Nothing's happening. But I'll tell you this. I've never appreciated the changing of the seasons as I did when I lived there. Because, you know, everything. I'm in LA, and you just don't really feel the change that much. But I appreciated the feeling of the passage of time. And you really appreciated the summer and the winter for what it offered, and the spring and fall, you really could see it. And like when you live on the East Coast and places where, you know, it snows, I do miss that. And I miss the land, and it's very serene. It brings you closer, I think, to the spirit of God and creation, to just have things slow down. There wasn't a lot of industrial areas, so you really appreciated nature. You got out more, you went to the beach more, you did walks, hikes, you did more things because there wasn't as much to do to distract you. So I miss that time in that place for that reason. It was so much more spiritual having that, like I said, that slowness, because, you know, we're so caught up in the day-to-day everything, hustle and bustle of life and all the distractions. And when you do that, you just get a little more, I think, close to the creator and with who you are and yourself. So I got a lot more, I'm already spiritual, but I think I got more, a lot more centered and okay with being alone, okay with time being still, okay with not having a lot of people around me and activity around me. So it was a very, it was an experience that helped my soul grow, I think, in a way that I didn't know that I might've needed it, because I grew up in the city so much. So I got used to the quiet and the stillness, spending the time with my father every day, and his quiet and stillness brought even more quiet and stillness made me even more okay with just being still. So many people are fighting and moving around and hustling and bustling, and they're not dealing with, I think, that inner spirit that needs to be addressed, whatever, past pains, past issues, things that are suppressed that we don't deal with because we're not still. So I see a lot of people that just can't sit still, the coronavirus and not being able to keep your day as busy. Just a lot of people are losing it. And because there's a lot they're not dealing with, I think, emotionally and inside internally, and you're forced to face it, and they're turning to things that are not healthy and breaking up and having a lot of issues. And it's really sad because, yeah, I think the whole universe is being forced to slow down and reflect and just heal with from within.
You know, being in a fast-paced environment like Los Angeles, you know, that weighs on you, where you got to keep that same energy moving forward to what you do every day. And, you know, as you just said, across the nation, everyone's trying to keep up to this life that they were doing until the world pretty much shut down and you had to reflect. And the blessing in disguise for you is that you were able to get a foreshadow of what it was going to be like in the future, but at the same time, you were able to slow down and appreciate the slowdown. I live in a
I
live in a place called Bakersfield, and like I grew up in LA and went back and forth as kids. And when my father died, my mother just stayed in Bakersfield pretty much. And you know, it wasn't as big as LA, but it had the aspirations of being a big city. And then when I, you know, my brother, he ended up going to a ranch and just settling down, and you got to hear just the distance between what I thought was a town, which was actually a city, to going to a town and reflecting on quiet and seldomness and actually having ability to reflect, to meditate, to just appreciate the slow downness of that. The time's not going as fast as I think it is now.
No, you're right. It's true. Some people are handling it the right way. Others are not, making the best mistake choices. But I think that, you know, it's just the universe now. Something bigger than ourselves has forced it. But when it first happened, you know, I was really forced to sit still because I had a back injury. So not only was I stuck, but I was like literally like stuck on the sofa. So with a back injury. So yeah, that sucked. But I think that you're right. It's something that we have to just work with and, you know, try to look at ourselves and hopefully make the right choices and decisions and go within and just know that everything is going to be okay. Everything's going to work out.
Absolutely.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Hannah, I got to tell you from the very beginning, time's the most finite thing we have on this earth. And I got to tell you that I appreciate your time. I appreciate you coming on the show and being transparent and just having this conversation with us on Contrast Uncut.
Thank you for having me. I'm always grateful to be asked and happy to do it.
There we go. Now, speaking of time, Hannah, what is a normal 24 hours for you?
Oh, man, it's different every day. What is my routine? Let me think. So I guess a normal 24 hours would probably just be on an average day that I have nothing to do. It would just be to wake up and I say a little prayer. It, you know, just literally from right away, waking up, feed my little dogs, open up all the windows because I like a lot of sunlight. I don't drink coffee, so I don't go into the kitchen for anything. And I just sort of like lollygag around, look at some books, read a little spiritual book passage here, there, call a few friends. That's how I wake up in the morning. and then get the day started. Right now with Corona happening, that's my typical day, the one I just described. So it's not the hustle and bustle to get anywhere, really. I like to take drives. My father loved taking drives. My favorite thing is to get in the car and just take a scenic drive. Yeah. And I feel like I'm out and, you know, walk around the neighborhood, be outside and visit with friends. So it's just, I've been doing a lot of movie watching lately. So because there's not much going on, and project planning, things like that, visiting with my grandmother, you know, things like that. So that my day-to-day hustle has changed. Before that, I retired from working with children. I used to work with kids, autistic kids, for 10 years. And then I retired from that, worked on my book, which took a lot of time and emotion out of me. It was very stressful. Mm-hmm. That was a labor of love. Doing the most recent book, the At Home with Muhammad Ali, that's the memoir. That was the most challenging project I ever had. And I said, I'm taking a long break from anything to do with writing after this, because I tend to focus on my father. I love him. They say, write what you know, what you love. And I just sort of, you know, compartmentalize the different projects and try to make them just different. And it gives me something to do next. But I haven't done any of that lately. So I haven't done any writing or anything in that regard. It's been more reflecting and being creative. I like to do quilting. I picked up a lot of habits, fun little hobbies when I was in Michigan, because there was nothing to do. So I learned how to sew. I learned how to knit. I learned how to quilt like a grandma. And I do a lot of that kind of stuff, just because I'm creative. I like to paint. That's a little messy for me, so I haven't been doing that. So nothing is really the same. Maybe because I have ADD and I'm a Leo, and I just like to change up what I do every day from here to here. So I switch between projects for fun and just connecting with people more than anything else.
Yes, that's
it's long-winded, I know, but...
No, not at all. Not at all. That just means you're well prepared.
And I've been doing a lot of traveling, visiting with sisters and things, and a lot more than normal. I like taking drives. So I get in the car and I drive out to Vegas and do that sort of thing, you know. But other than that, in the beginning stages, my husband and I just watched TV nonstop, you know, television. I didn't want to go anywhere too much because I was a little nervous about the coronavirus. But now I'm still safe. But I go out and go places and see people and just get tested and keep my mask on. So, yeah.
Yes. No, that's something my wife and I enjoy to do the most. It's something that she sort of jumped on the bandwagon of. What I enjoy doing is just taking scenic drives. I love like Topanga Canyon. I love driving from Malibu to any parts that spit you out to the 101. Or, you know, pretty much LA has so many different views and locations for you to go. And I wouldn't say get lost, because we find new ways to get there. And when you said that right now, it's a surreal serenity, minus traffic. If you could take back routes to get to places and get there and enjoy the scene, then not think about how fast you're going, then that's the best way to go.
Yeah, we would go down to Malibu and into the marina, and we'd look at the boats and sit and eat and just watch the boats going in and out. You know, so that was the beginning days of what was going on. So that brought peace. And it was there was nobody in the streets back then. So it's changed a little bit now.
In the air. I remember seeing pictures of LA, no pollution.
No, nothing. It's beautiful. It's clear and very, very, very just, I guess peaceful in a sense, but not a lot of people around, but you know, the cars are back out. So just looking now in the streets, it looks like world is normal. So I only realize it's not when I see all the masks and try to go eat somewhere. We're outside and only have a few tables. We have to wait an hour to sit down and eat. But yeah, it's crazy. This is like the new norm. I'm getting used to it.
Oh, unfortunately, I can't wait till we get a step closer back to normalcy. I promise.
Right. Right here. So I agree.
So, Hannah, I have a quote. You know, let me know how this quote relates to you, or if it doesn't, the ideas, I want you to talk about it. But let me go with my hunch and see if I was right. Here we go. Service to others is the rent you pay for your room here on earth. Muhammad Ali.
Yes, he's another way of saying that too. Service to others here on earth is the rent you pay for your room in heaven.
Whoo!
That's the way he normally says it, but he's been quoted saying it twice, so people hear the way you said it more often. But his original...
Run that back. I was a deep... I gotta have...
Yeah, so his... the original quote that he says is, service to others here on earth is the rent you pay for your room in heaven. Like it? That's the authentic, most authentic version of that quote, because he said it twice, more than once, but that's the way he said it the most. And for some reason, it's been reprinted more the other way. Service to others is the rent you pay for your room here on earth, but it's the other way around. Yeah. You like that better too, don't you?
Oh yeah. Better, because the powerful meaning behind it, like, you know, there's more to it, like, but that, I guess when I was reading that initially, I was like, that gives you so much more to say. But in reflecting reality, there's so much more there's so much more importance and abundance left out of that quote to make it really reach home. Then it's like, wow.
Yes. And my father, you know, it could go both ways, but my father, everything he did in his life was trying to get to heaven. He was very spiritual, very religious. He made his mistakes, of course, as we all know, he was not faithful. And, but he was, even in the way he handled that, you had to commend him. He brought all of his children together. He was friendly with all of his wives, ex-wives. I mean, he handled every divorce settlement out of court. He was more than generous. He was very, just a great human being. And even in his flaws, I really believe that the true test of a man's character, a person's character, is how they handle their flaws. And he made mistakes, but he owned up to his responsibilities. He didn't make excuses for himself. My father never played the victim in anything. He owned up to it. And like I said, brought us all together. And, you know, he was an amazing, amazing person. So he just was trying to get to heaven and to make people happy and to do right by his mistakes and to inspire people and uplift and help people. He genuinely loved helping people. And I mean, I grew up with homeless people living in our house for days at a time until, you know, my mom would then put them in a hotel, but my dad would bring them home. And, you know, he loved rolling up and down his Rolls Royce, the top down of Wilshire Boulevard. And I love diners now are my favorite place to go because they're hard to find. But I grew up in diners with my father having clam chowder and coffee and at Carnations that used to be on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles and a Bob's Big Boy that's no longer there now. Now it's a, you know, a BMW dealership. But all of these memories are, you know, ingrained in me. And the one thing that I have to say that I can't separate from the memories is how much he tried to help people. You know, he'd pile them into the car with us. And I just remember being a little girl smelling a bad smell. And it's because, you know, there were homeless people. So he would bring them in the restaurant, sit them right down, feed them. He loved sharing his food. I mean, even if people came over, they would come to the house. If he was eating, he would take half a sandwich and shove it in your face, a complete stranger. He was just such a gracious, giving person and soul. He loved being Muhammad Ali. He loved the magic that he could see that came from that, just what he could do for people by inspiring them. He really felt, it sounds funny, but he used to always say, I'm not just your daddy, hon. I'm a daddy to the world. He really thought that he was like this person that the world looked up to, especially the Black community in the times he came up. So it was important for him to exert Black confidence, pride, love, self-respect, self-love, not to lead people astray, because when you're in a position of power or leadership or fame, what you have a responsibility, he used to say, that comes with that fame. And if you don't want it, it just comes with it. You're in the wrong profession. So you don't get something for nothing. And he always understood that and always wanted to lead people in the right direction and make the right choices in life. And he knew that he could influence people. So that was very important to him. And, you know, you don't get that a lot these days. People want the fame, they want the power, but they forget that everything you do sends a message about your image. And if you can influence people in any way, hopefully they're doing it in a positive way. It's not about the money. You're not selling out to that. And you're really trying to just owning up to the responsibilities that come with that fame, that attention, and that platform. And I think Daddy is so loved and respected because there weren't really, I don't know anybody really that was that way. You know, he was just such a hero. He never fell from grace. You know, he never disgraced people. He always was just so gracious and so positive. And even in the way he lost fights, complimenting the other fighter. And, you know, Joe Frazier brought out the best in me. God bless him. You know, he would sell and promote his fights with, you know, the talk, sell him tickets. But he knew how to lose gracefully. He was just such an amazing human being, athlete, hero, role model.
and I just loved him more than life itself and miss him more than anything in the world. So I'm always grateful and love talking about my dad, but I'm going on a tangent now. So let me give you a word so you can get a word in edgewise. The show will be over. I'll still be talking about daddy.
Quite honest, your father was such an amazing person. Like, there would be no term GOAT. There would be no greatest of all time unless there was a man like your father to set as the example, to set as the standard of what a real man should look like, and then pursue that. And knowing that that pressure was on his shoulders, he absorbed it. He was like, this is another hit to my stride. And, you know, that's one thing real gracious and gratitude for, that not only did he leave that presence with us is what we saw on camera, but in reflection, he left it at home with you. We only got a small smidget of what we got to see on camera, 15, 16 rounds, 14 rounds, and the hype before it, and just the way how he did everything. It taught you how to win respectfully. It taught you how to be boisterous, be confident about what you're doing. Because if you're not confident, you're not comfortable, you're not great. And that brother, he exerted the definition of greatness when it came, he did.
Right. So you're right.
When I read that quote, granted that the internet messed me up and misquoted it, it led something with me is that you're paying the service to get to heaven based upon the fact that you're giving your father's legacy, because that's what the world's missing. The world is missing.
You're right.
To lead the platform and see what a real man's supposed to look like. There's the right way to look, and then there's the left way, the wrong way, and everyone's trying to find a way to the right way. But if we don't know what right looks like, you know, it's a trouble to put that puzzle together. And that's been a huge blessing of why we have these books that you've been able to put out and just, you know, share the light, shed the light, and continuing shedding the light.
Well, you know, it's funny because my father used to teach us young. He'd say, you have an angel on your left shoulder, and you got one on your right shoulder, and the one on the left is writing down all your good deeds, and the one on the right is writing down all your bad deeds, and one day you're going to die. He's like, this life is so short compared to the eternal life. And he said, you're going to go to heaven or you're going to go the other way. And he says, but when you do die, God is going to play your life to you like a movie. You know, he was so theatrical. We were like 7 years old, 6 years old, sitting with our eyes open, listening to this. But as I grew, he would teach those lessons coming, and he would just talk about how everyday
life. Anna?
Yes.
Oh, I'm losing you, girl.
Uh-oh, hold on a second. How about now?
We're better on sound, sorry.
That's okay, tell me if you lose it. But he was just telling me, he would teach us how every day is a choice, and you know, this life goes by so fast, and so many people get caught up in the darker things in this world and the things that aren't meaningful, and they waste time. They waste the days. They waste the moments that are so precious with people they love, whatever, just by the choices they're making. And it's really sad, but you know, everyone has to live their journey. Can't choose for them. You can't do anything, but you know, try to keep your own mind in the right place and make the right decisions and surround yourself with people. He used to always say, that are doing good, because it's so easy to get caught up and forget and lose your way. And it's easier for darkness to influence light than it is for the light to influence the dark. So surround yourself with people that are better than you and like you and keep you on the right path, and always go within to make the choices, and, you know, listen to that angel on the left of your shoulder that's telling you the positivity and ignore the negative. And, you know, he really instilled that in his children and all of us growing up. And it gave us, I think, the strength and foresight and understanding to be able to navigate in life and make the right choices, and to be strong for the people you might know and love that aren't as strong, fight in the right way, or make the right choices for yourself. Like my father, I tend to forgive anything and everything. I'm overly forgiving. My dad was that way, even to their own point, to his own detriment. You know, I'm one of those people where if someone's sorry, it's just, okay, they're sorry. It doesn't matter what they did, really. I can forgive. And I get that from my dad, I think. And I see it as a blessing. I'm glad I'm that way. I don't have any resentment inside, or I don't hold on to negative feelings that can just, you know, cause people to act out in ways that aren't very delicate or positive. I just let it go. You know, one of the greatest lessons I got from him, or I guess from my genes, I would say that the ability for myself to just forgive and know that everyone's here on their own life path, trying to find their way, and they're going to make their mistakes, and you can just pray and hope that they find their way. And just people that you love, you know, friends, family, whoever, strangers, whatever. Just so if people can, I think, take that from the many lessons that my father has was on this earth, I think, to teach. It's the forgiveness, the humanity is his greatest accomplishment, his humanity, because it's so hard for people to love and forgive and understand. They only think about their own pains, their own hurts, and they can't see clearly through that. It's like you can't see the forest for the trees. And he was just amazingly humble to be the most loved and famous person that ever walked this earth, with how big he got at a time where there's only three television stations, no social media, so well loved because it was his humanity. And you know, that's the hardest thing and the hardest lesson. I thought my dad didn't believe in reincarnation, but I do. And he must have lived 1,000 lives because he had that in spades, the forgiveness and the humanity. And I used to always tell him he was an angel on this earth and the only little flaws you have are because you're human. So, you know, but
it's an extreme blessing to understand that you don't allow any darkness to get into your positivity of light. And that is because you get it into your, but it's also obscured through your brain. It's processed that way. But, you know, it goes back to the core. It's easy for you to just forgive and move forward. It's the biggest problem for people across this whole world, because a lot of the things that they want to unleash and get closer to, they can't forgive themselves. They can't forgive others. And from that, you know, it leaves a lot of negativity on the heart. It leaves a lot of sorrow. It leaves that potential of getting greater and closer to seeing a happier life, a happier side of yourself, further away, because forgiveness is the key to happiness. And I'm so happy you brought that up and that, you know, you recognize it's a gift, because a lot of people think it's just naive, and that's wrong. If you think, you know, my kindness for weakness, Hana's kindness for weakness is a thing, then, you know, you're really wrong with the inside of really how this life works and how the blessings continue to pour in, and, you know, why walls are up there and why you have to overcome and build foundations to success and to push that direction.
No, you're right. It's very hard for people to forgive. It just comes naturally. I can forgive before the person's even sorry. Like, I just say they're a human being. They're on their life journey. They might not be as advanced in certain areas as other people. So I have that understanding. It just comes innate within me. And then, you know, my mom used to always tease me, you're just like your father. You don't get mad to the degree you should for the things that are done sometimes. So I just can't. I can't. It doesn't mean that you don't know better, that you're stupid, or you don't see the truth, or, you know, can't make certain decisions that are good for yourself. It just means you can let go of the anger quick. It might be a fleeting feeling that goes so fast, just like as quick as it comes. And then it's more of the pain maybe, or the, you know, from a betrayal, but it goes quick. Right. I mean, it doesn't even last more than that moment. It goes away right away. And I have this calm and I just forgive them. It's like, it's just forgiven. Without even a discussion about it. It's like, okay, everyone's a human being here. No one's perfect. Who knows what people go through in their life, how they see things. They didn't have the same father I did, the same mother, the same genes, the same life experiences. So we're all here to learn lessons in life. You know, some people just have a problem, I think, at making it more personal. They don't realize that it's not about how, you know, the mistakes that people make doesn't reflect how they really feel about you. They have their own lessons to learn, their own insecurities, their own just stuff, shit they're dealing with. So if you can just remove that poor me syndrome out of it, you'll be able to see things more clearly. And it's sad because a lot more relationships and friendships, whatever, romantic relationships, all relationships would work and last a little better if people would just take the whole, victimization out of things that happen, or them making it me. Like, if you have a father that was never showing up, or a mother that was always late. You know, as kids, we think, oh, that means they don't love us. I'm not important. And we grow up thinking incorrectly about those things, and it transcends into our adult life. And we might be more sensitive to certain things that come up because of things that happened in the past. And it just makes everything more complicated. And if we just remember that we're all human beings, we're here to make mistakes, to hopefully live and hopefully grow from them, and hopefully to learn to value what's most important in life and do the hard things, so that you can have the things that are most important in life and make those decisions. A lot of people have to go through life and they have too many losses until they realize it on their deathbed. And it's sad. So it's like, I like to read the self-help books, listen to the people that have been here before me, and know how to just judge life experiences and people in a way that is not judgmental, and just, it helps you heal and keeps the cancers away keeps you in a mental state of it, just being okay, by understanding that. So yeah, it's a good thing. I think I'm grateful for it. I thank God every day that I have my spirit that I inherited from both parents. Really, they're both very forgiving. My father is just above and out of the world with it, you know. And so I'm glad I got that, because it keeps my heart at peace, and it keeps just your spirit and your soul strong. And but I think that, you know, everyone's at a different stage in life. You know, we all grow differently. We learn from the people that come in. Hopefully we take the great lessons and we incorporate them in forward, because it just keeps your spirit evolving. And this life goes by so fast. Like my father used to always say, he had me scared to go to sleep. You know, he's like, it's going to go by so fast. So what's it all for, if not to grow and enjoy the people that you love and know what's important in life, and then to be able to forgive, because people are going to make mistakes, you know? So it's like, they're not perfect. And as long as it's not hurting you in a way that's going to kill your spirit, you know, I think that it's good for people to keep those people around and try to help them through their what they're doing too. And they're, you know, if you, especially if you have strengths that other people don't, instead of just dropping them and forgetting about them and moving on, if people could help other people grow, that's a beautiful thing. And my father was that way. So people would steal from him. They would betray him. They would do certain things that, you know, you'd think he'd get rid of them, but instead he kept them. He said, they're my family. I love them. And he tried to help them through. And it's really a lot easier for people to discard people. But, you know, they're not shoes, they're not clothes. So it's like, you know, you can't help what people are going to do, but you can help what you're going to do. So if people just did that in life, then I think they'll be in a very more peaceful place, because it feels good. Your spirit feels good. And I think that's what that quote's about, you know, service to other here on earth. It's not just about helping the needy in terms of monetary ways, but spiritual ways and just being there for people, just period. Because it's, you know, people need help. We're not perfect. Emotional things can happen, and it gets hard in life. So if you can help somebody else get through and stand by them and show them that you're a rock for them, that just might make a breakthrough in their life, you know, and save them in some way.
So, I was told at a young age, control what you can control and let go and let God do the rest. And, you know, if
exactly.
People trespass you, then let them trespass you, because you know what? You can only control what you can control. And, you know, if you let go of your battles, you know, they will at some point come back to you and, you know, want or need your guidance or need your help. And I don't want to word it as like they have to come back to you, but God has a way of, you know, giving the inner choice of you, of giving that spirit of likeliness and forgiveness. It brings them back to you to be humble, and so that they can grow together with you to see the bigger picture. Because a lot of the time you're referring to is you see the bigger picture. You see the rest of the canvas, that people are only so focused on that dot that someone just put in front of them, and you see the rest of the board. And that right there is very, very important. That's instilled the values. And
you are right. I agree.
I got to ask you a question, Hannah. Speaking about
an
author, a writer, you know, did the game choose you, or did you choose the game? Was it a natural process? Like, you know,
I'll tell you, it happened accidentally. I've always written poetry, but I say to myself, I want to write books. How it happened was, when I was in college, my father, for Father's Day, my dad didn't care about material items. So I thought, for Father's Day, I'm going to go to Kinko's, and I'm going to put together a book of memories and pictures. He loved pictures of happy memories, and put it together with him like a book. And my mother had an agent who was trying to get her to write a book, which she never did. And, my mom said, this looks like a book. So she showed it to Susan Crawford, and she, Susan loved it. And it got published. That was More Than a Hero. And that was my first book. And then the second one was The Soul of a Butterfly, that was by my father with me. And that came about because Susan came to me and said, somebody wants a spiritual book on your father. And I was already in Michigan. I thought, I could do that. So we started working on that. And that was just reflections on life's journey, things that happened to him that were defining moments that were a huge part of who he was and the decisions he made. And we did that. And then the third book is my memoir, At Home with Muhammad Ali. Actually, you know what? Ali on Ali, a coffee table book, actually came out before that. And I worked on that with someone else. And it was just a compilation of photographs and quotes my father said, why he said what he said when he said it. So that came out just while I was still writing my memoir. And 2018, I think it came out in 2019. So the memoir, though, was the greatest, my greatest accomplishment, my greatest literary speaking likewise. It was the greatest accomplishment because it was so difficult and it transcended. It started off as just being a documentation of the audio recordings my father made. He made a set of recordings he gave me about 100 hours, not that long, maybe about 80 hours worth of just recorded calls from like the years 1978 to 1983, the majority of them being made between 79 and 81. And he documented everything, his return to the ring, his worries about money, his finances, talking with George Foreman, trying to get George Foreman to come out of retirement, get back his title, go out a winner. George is trying to convince my dad to come back to Christianity. They have a beautiful recording call for an hour, these two adversaries in the ring, friends, you know. And of course, eventually, George does come back and take the title. And he's trying to convince my father not to come out of retirement. And he had a premonition that he shouldn't do it, you know, and he was right. So, but everything happens as it's supposed to in the world. So, and my father understood that. So he had no regrets in that regard, because it all unfolds how it's supposed to. And he always had this amazing faith in that. And so the recordings were just so plentiful. I thought, I'll just document them. He's so, you know, he's recording us singing and laughing, going to school, trying to free hostages in Tehran, eavesdropping on my mom's phone calls, just all kind of different stuff. Laughing, just talking about life and his hopes and plans and worries, like I said. And I learned things about him I never knew. And they were just the greatest thing he ever did. I told him the greatest accomplishment. I said, Daddy, I'm so grateful for these. And I thought, I'm going to transcribe them. And just, they were so funny talking to different, you know, he's calling people, wishing them a Merry Christmas, even though he's a Muslim, on Christmas. Merry Christmas. This is Muhammad Ali, just random numbers in the phone book. He'd get hung up on sometimes. Other people would just, how'd you get my number? You know, so I just picked up the phone and dialed. How you doing? You know, talking to complete strangers. So he's got this all recorded and it's just the most, the greatest gift. So they were entertaining enough to just hold their own. But my publisher said, well, let's have a little backstory on each call. So then it became just doing a little backstory on each call. And then it grew to, how about I give my sisters a chapter to share their memories? And then it just kind of felt like mine were top heavy, or it just didn't, it wasn't flowing quite right. So then it became a memoir. So I was like, I never written a memoir because I wrote this book by myself. So I said, like the others, but the others were easy because they're more like an essay style. This was like, I had to tell a story and I'm telling three stories, mine with my father, his and my mother and my father's story, and incorporating the recordings to bring it to life, to give the dialogue and coming in and out of the past and the present. So it was a challenge like nothing other. I read like five how-to books, got it together, did it, accomplished it. And but like I said, it was twice as long as it was supposed to be. It's over 350 pages. So it was just a labor of love. And I am so proud that I got that done. And while my father was still here, you know, I was working on it while he was still alive, so I could still share some of the bits and pieces of it with him. So yeah, that was my greatest accomplishment. But that's how I got into writing. It was just an accident because I put something together that my mom thought was so good and you know, an agent agreed with, and it went from there. Always an accident. The only one I did on purpose, the only book I did on purpose that I intentionally set out to write was my memoir, At Home with Muhammad Ali. So that was the only one that I intended to write. The others sort of fell on my lap.
So Hannah, so I had Marvin Gaye III on as my season finale for season 3, and He has a musical called Pride and Joy. And it's to showcase his mother and his father's love for each other. And, you know, it's something that's very lost in the translations. And, you know, that's one thing that he felt near and dear to his heart. So he did a musical and it went around the world and he's keeping it up. Well, COVID shut it down, but once COVID, life opens back up. And so it had me thinking as I've been reading about and hearing the audibles, you know, I'm like, will there be another step from the memoirs and books to a play or to a series? Or, because, you know, love stories is something that, you know, just like the standards of being a man, a love story, a true love story is dismissed. And when you look at the love and just the chase that your father had for your mother, you know, that's so detailed and just so rich that, you know, that's a real high school love that they say, puppy love. And that's so organic and real, you know, and people search for that their entire lives. And I feel like that's something that's just missing from seeing that, you know, come about.
Yeah, it's funny you said that, because I'm actually starting a podcast based just on the book. And it's just At Home with Muhammad Ali, and I would have different people on. I haven't actually recorded one yet. It's in the beginning stages, but it would just be At Home with Muhammad Ali podcast. And hopefully I'll find some time in the next month to get that first episode out. But I'm still trying to figure out how to go about that, you know, so who to have as a first guest and just make it about the book and the memories. And like you said, the relationships and just, yeah. But there is an audio book out of At Home with Muhammad Ali, and I chose not to read for it. I did read the epilogue at the end, but I chose not to read the book because there's a certain amount of breathing that goes into doing this, and an actor would do much better. There's so much acting in my book, and I wanted it to be well received and easy to get through. So I didn't want it to be, you know, I wasn't reading it properly, or it's a long book. So I'm so proud of the woman I chose to do it. She read for a book I listened to called Kindred, and she had the most beautiful voice, most pleasant voice. Her name is Kim Stoughton. So I sought her out and found out she lived in LA, had a lot of connections with my father and Malcolm X and our parents in the past. It was a coincidence. So she read for the book, and it's available anywhere audiobooks are sold, audible.com, audiobooks.com. But it's my sister Maymay, just absolutely, that's how she read the book. She listened to it on a trip, a road trip to Vegas and home. And she said she was laughing and crying, and she just absolutely loved it because Kim Stoughton was just brilliant. She does it for, you know, like I said, she's a voice actor. So she did an amazing job being a woman, being my father. You know how hard it is to be daddy. So I would recommend people to listen to the audiobook for sure, because it comes to life. And the actual book, you have a lot of photographs spread throughout, at least 90 or 80 photographs I put in there. And I chose to opt to put them with the stories, and also the documentations and things I talk about, like the love letters we discovered my father wrote, my mother never gave her in storage. We found them. They're in the back, in the glossary. The things I talked about in the book, I actually put copies of in the back for people to see. So there's a pro, and there's pros to having both. But definitely I would say, yes, there is an audiobook version, and I want to do the podcast. And if there's a play or a movie, I don't know. I mean, someone would have to contact me for that, but I'm not actually actively trying to make that happen.
Oh, well, I think, yeah, a musical would be dope, or a play would be really, really just incredible to see just the action and what you guys feel, right, the impressions to put throughout. But speaking of Audible, I have heard it. It is 15 hours, and I'm not going to lie, 4 hours went by, and I didn't even realize it was 4 hours that had went by just listening, laughing, and just enjoying the stories. It's just...
Thank you. So you have heard it.
Yes,
thank you.
Amazing. And you gave me insight to the end, because I haven't got to the end yet on my Audible version. And I'm like, oh, so your voice is on at the end. Because I was thinking, like, how does she just get that balance? But I know it's not easy to read for 15 hours, and you have to keep
right
that up. And then, you know, it's, you have to enunciate like you're working with Dr. Dre, you know.
Yeah, you're right. So she did it in 3 days. She was very good. And I just went in there. I recorded the very end. So it's my voice talking about the dream that I had that closes it all out. So it's the epilogue, yeah. You'll hear the difference probably in the voice, but yeah, people don't know that. So it's me recording the epilogue. It's about, I don't know, it's not maybe a few minutes. Yeah, at the very end. So, and you are also gonna get audio clips, real audio clips. I forgot to mention that. Ooh. You'll have 5 minutes of the actual recordings of me and my father singing together, and my father telling why he made the tapes. So that's also in the audio version at the end.
And you know what? As I'm thinking about it, hit me like a ton of bricks. This era that you have these audio recordings is when he was on, you know, his latter end of his career. He's focusing on, I'm about to retire. He came out of retirement. And you have just that era caught on, you know, on tape, which is amazing, because his energy, is the battles, those are huge decisions that he's living through daily.
Yes, he was really struggling with whether he should come back and fight Holmes or not, and he documents it all. He's talking to his lawyers, asking for advice, talking about how he believes he can make it. He's plotting his comeback. I don't know if you got that far yet in the book. I think it might be chapter 10, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure, but it's chapter 10 where he talks about this stuff, that's how I used to start the book. Like, oh my God, I've started it and ended it so many different ways, but it kept evolving. So that is very important, because it humanizes my father. It might shock a lot of people when you actually listen to that, him talking about his concerns and why he's so stressed. And it really humanizes him for people who don't really know. You always think people know the person the way you know them, but they don't. And they know him in the world, but he was very candid, very easy for him to express and share his feelings, my dad. A lot of men have a problem doing that. My dad didn't. So he talks about his worries, and he's recording it all for history. So he knew what he was doing. He's always ahead of his time. He's really, like, essentially, he created the first, you know, reality show at a time when he was sitting there thinking, isn't this something, like, one day they're going to put one tape, he's saying, one day they might play these on some great radio station if they pay the price. He was always thinking ahead. So he even says that throughout the tape, so many tapes. You're going to be so glad I did this one day. I'm so history conscious and history minded, and I'm always thinking about life, and life is so fleeting and beautiful. We don't always realize it. So that's why I'm making these tapes. And he's talking to my future self as my three-year-old self sits beside him listening. And he's telling me why he made the tapes. And it's my favorite tape. So I wanted to share that. So that's at the end. So you'll get to it. You'll get to hear it.
Oh, wow. That's so amazing. Oh, my Lord.
Tell me how. Make sure you text me. You got my number. Text me how you like it when you finish it, because I always like to hear. I read reviews online, which reminds me, I haven't read them in the past month or so. I got to go on there. I reply to people's reviews, too.
Ooh.
And I love reading what people think about the book. It makes me feel good because it was so hard. I worked so hard. It's my greatest accomplishment. And like I said, I'm so grateful for all the people that actually did read it, especially the people who are in my life that know the story. It meant a lot that they took the time to do that. Like, I can't even say, you know, because it was, like I said, it was my, that book is my whole heart. My father is my heart and soul and spirit. So I think he's my soulmate, you know, the greatest love of my life. And always will be. So I really appreciate everybody out there that takes the time. And I hope that you have a better understanding about him, and hope that he inspires you to make the right choices in your own lives and to love people and to live every moment in grace and gratitude and just charitable and loving and just really live this life and not get caught up in all the negativity, the drugs and the mistreatment and the money and the fame seeking. And you know, it's just so sad because it doesn't really give you anything. It's not fulfilling. It doesn't really do anything for you. People do, you know, so cultivate the relationships and give love and receive love and just spend time loving and growing. And I think that will be the greatest accomplishment of any human being, because none of this stuff, what job you have, how much money you make, really matters. It gets you through the ends, the days ins and the days out. But if you lose sight of what's really important, I mean, what's it all for? It's a wasted life, you know? So hopefully people find their way and they find some inspiration from my father's story. And like I said, he handled the hardest things with such grace and dignity. And it never wavered his faith. He used to say, God's my bodyguard. You know, I can't go out here and not live life and walk down these streets and people and worrying about somebody getting me. Because if someone's going to get me, nobody can stop them but God. So God's my bodyguard. And he didn't let it stop him. He walked the streets free without anybody. I mean, his bodyguard was not really a bodyguard. You know what I mean? So anyway, I hope that they get something from it and it changes who they are inside. I get a lot of that with The Soul of a Butterfly. People tell me that it changed them. So I hope that this book gives greater insight into who my father really was and helps people grow and be happy and just do something to change the world, change people in some way. So.
Yeah, no, because it pretty much broke down the reality that, you know, this hype of everyone thinking that he's unbreakable. He's, you know, he is the greatest man on earth, but at the same time, he bleeds just like everybody else. He breathes just like everybody else. He still sleeps. He's still a man at the very end of the day. And it's so important that people remind themselves that, because he had to go through so much just to go through the decisions he made. He had to sacrifice so much. You said it yourself in the beginning. He felt the whole world was his kids. And, you know, I still feel like to this day that he is my father because of the amount of knowledge he gives me. And about him.
Yes. Yes. A lot of people say that to me, that your father was like my father. I look to him for guidance. And I think you're right. And my father, the only part of my father that was unbreakable was his spirit and the love in his heart. Nothing would ever change that. Not sickness, not loss, not failure, not anything. That was always steadfast. Nothing anyone could take from him would take that away. And that is why he was so strong. And the part that he would say that, you know, the physicality, because we're human, that part, of course, he would say, you know, God gave me Parkinson's to show you and to show me that I'm not Superman. I'm just a man like everybody else. It humbled him. So he got to live the full spectrum of his life here on this earth. And even the getting sick at the end is part of his journey here because it humbles him. And he was already humble, even though he knew he was great. It was like a dichotomy. He had, you know, it seems like a contradiction, but he knew he was the greatest, knew it was important to say it, especially for Black pride and morale and anyone on the downside of advantage. But then he also knew that, okay, I am just a man like anybody else. I'm human, you know, and he loved people. And he wasn't afraid to say that. So, but that taught him great lessons, you know, to be quiet, to be stilled after being so fast, so strong, so fluent in speech. He didn't feel sorry for himself, not ever. He didn't dwell on his sickness. He would forget sometimes that, do people know I have it? I'm like, yeah. Because he didn't wake up thinking, I have Parkinson's, you know? He just took it a day at a time. My father didn't go against the tide. He just flowed with him. And that was just a lesson that he came to this earth with. So he went through the stages where he was in denial or he was embarrassed to talk and he would be quiet because he didn't like that people did not understand him, but he moved through that quickly and gracefully. And he learned life's lessons and he embraced it with a spirit of understanding and acceptance that I don't know who has on this earth. At least, I mean, he would even say that there was people taking stands all over the world and doing right, but you don't know about them. They're little people living in their houses that you don't know about because they're not famous, you know, but they're here, they're on this earth. And the people that don't have that faith, at least now that he can stand up and show them that they can get up too and keep going and help inspire them. So he always found the good in anything that happened to him in life, even the negative. So he's just so amazing that words just can't express it. So I just wanted to share every part of him because he didn't belong to me, to us. He belonged to the world. And I learned that when I was 4 years old. So I've always been sharing my father and I have no problem doing it. And I love, you know, like I said, so I will just keep writing as much as I can. If there's always something new to come out that's not redundant, I'll do it because I don't know. I just feel like part of my legacy is to carry on his. So and we are happy to do so.
We are very, very grateful for it.
You know, well, thank you.
I do want to ask is that, you know, him being born in Louisville, Kentucky, and everything going on in Occupy Kentucky and just with Until Freedom and just so many different groundworks that they're doing, educating and doing stuff on Tuesday and just, you know, the amount of information they're educating the communities on how to, you know, interact with the police and how to protest and how to pretty much grow. You know, my question is like, what would Muhammad Ali be able to ensue to all the people, or what some of the writings that they should be having to parlay to the people from Until Freedom that Muhammad Ali's had?
That last part, you went out, I'm sorry.
Yeah, pretty much what would some insight or some information that Muhammad Ali from his memoirs and writings that would be able to be used for Until Freedom and what's going on in Kentucky?
Let me think. So something that he said that can be used to inspire based on what's going on right now?
Yes.
Let me think.
He faced so much scrutiny. He faced so much racism. He faced from all walks of life and even, you know, quoted as saying that racism is wrong no matter your color of your skin. And
right, right.
And that's so much power to what he, you know, what he embodies and what he stands for. And I feel like they should use more of Muhammad Ali's innate ability of, you know, his feelings, his demeanor, his the way how he moved, the way he thought. Some of that energy should be transferred to what's going on out there in Kentucky.
Well, I agree, because it's happening all over the world, really, you know, and there's certain places right now where the spotlight's on. But I just feel that my father would, you know, if he were here, it would break his heart, of course. But he would say, you know, he would be for Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter. And he would understand and explain probably better that why it's important for people that are saying Black Lives Matter, because we know that white lives have mattered in history. It's the Black and the brown lives that have not been respected, that have not been cherished. So that's the importance for all the people who don't understand the Black Lives Matter movement, that unknowingly or ignorantly, or just because they just don't care, state all lives matter in a sense that they don't understand, I think, why the focus is on Black lives and brown lives mattering. No one ever said white lives didn't matter, any other lives didn't matter, but they're not the ones that we're losing every day by the thousands, tens of thousands, and nothing's changing. So I think that it would break his heart. But, you know, at the same time, my father was a little boy coming up in a time where, you know, he would be walking home from school and there'd be Black people hanging from trees, lynched. And that people were getting off, even with white eyewitnesses. So while there's been progress, it hasn't changed. It's just, he would say what he's always said, that a lot of people don't know. And that is this, that change has to start with the children. Because what we're already, as adults, poisoned with the prejudices that we grew up seeing, the subtle images, the subtle things that are said and shown that make people, you know, prejudice and not even realize it. Clutch your purse when a dark, thin Black man walks by. Get scared, you know, when you see certain things and images that were projected in life. And he knows that. So it's like what we teach our children is what's going to change the future. So change has to start with the kids because they're the new generations to come. And if parents would just wake up to all this and stop with the stereotypes, watch what they're saying, watch what people are watching, that's where the change happens, because that's how we are now anyway. The few people that were children when we were getting lynched 50 years ago, that keep progressing and growing. And it's sort of slowly changing, but it's not enough because we're still dying and the prejudice is still there. So it's going to take time, but it has to start with the children. That's what my father would say. That's what he would promote. Start now teaching the children that we're going to be molding and teaching for the new future generations what the right is, what the wrongs are, to love, to forgive, to stop seeing color the way we're seeing it. And it's sad, you know, that we're still here, but we are adults and a lot of us in our minds are already poisoned. So I think that people who are committing these crimes and the hate that they have inside, we can't really change them. You might scare them. They might, you know, go into hiding, do it in a different way and subtly, but it's really hard. It's going to take time to change those people. So we, like I said, we got to focus on working on the ones that are younger, that really are going to be the future, so that the future generations aren't having these problems. And the Breonna Taylors and her parents in the future aren't crying because another Black life was lost. Another person was killed unjustly, you know? So I think that's what's important, because we don't want to breed and teach hate either in these people who are lost souls that are doing the wrong. So you just teach them how we're supposed to be feeling and teach them how we should view the world and each other, and patience and tolerance, not hate or abuse of power. So if we can do that, I think the future has a chance of being really positive and different. But the focus does have to be with the kids, and that's what my father would say.
Absolutely. No, children are free spirit. They are not prejudiced. They're born in this world free. Right. And, you know, they can only grow to what they're taught. And when you said that, your father's quote, it made me think of another quote from Frederick Douglass. And he said, it's easier to build strong children than it is to repair broken men. And
yes,
all they do is tie in the fact that we have to invest more time into our youth and educating. And I feel like knowledge is power, but when you use that knowledge, it becomes your superpower. And
exactly,
awareness as we can, let's do it. I got, you know, just a couple more questions and then I promise you I'm out of here. I'm sorry. I'm enjoying myself, and I think I probably
won't. Thank you. It's okay.
Okay.
It's okay. We've been an hour, but I still can talk. I can still talk. Keep on. Good. Bring it on.
Hey, my welcome. Okay, my family's from the South, like, you know, Michigan in the South, and you know, the one thing I want to do is overstay your welcome. Okay.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
So I like the show Growing Up Hip Hop, and it influences my next question. May you please share with us your top three growing up boxing moments?
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Boxing moments. You know what? I don't watch boxing.
No. I'm saying because, you know, one thing, a lot of people from Growing Up Hip Hop, I don't know if you've never seen the show, but pretty much it's showcasing what the influence of their parents' lives have influenced you, whether I've read that you've seen was it Clint Eastwood and John Travolta come by the house? And those are the things I'm talking about, because your father was the champ. And
oh, growing up, you're talking about like how, got it. So you're talking about what life was like at home.
Yes.
People coming around.
But, you know, yeah, growing up boxing, so that we don't steal from or take away from another way of saying it.
Got it. I thought you were asking like what my three boxing moments, meaning like what fights. I was gonna say the only boxing I watched was not close to boxing, was my husband's UFC fights, and those were thrilling when I wasn't worried, you know. But he always looked good, so he never really, even when he lost, he he lost gracefully and, you know, not bad. So it wasn't hard. But yeah, no, I don't watch sports. But back to that, what you just said, now that I understand the question, let me see. My favorite moments probably was, you know, Michael Jackson, of course, because I was a little girl, loved Michael Jackson. And he would come and visit my dad. And last time I saw him, though, was when I asked him, why do you talk like a girl? And he said, I guess God made me that way. But yeah, fun moments like that happened all the time. My father loved having company. He actually loved entertaining everyday people more than he did celebrities. He loved pumping them up and pumping people up. He loved to say, Hana, come here. That's the world's greatest chef talking about our cook. Or that's the world's greatest mailman. He can deliver more mail than anybody on the block. He loved to pump people up, make them feel good. So whatever celebrity did come by the house, it was the same thing. That's the Clint Eastwood was the world's greatest actor, or, you know, whatever singer would come by, you know, whoever. But there were so many. And at the time, I was too young to appreciate who anybody was. And my father always made all people seem important. So I could never tell the difference between them. It wasn't until later in life that I would realize those were celebrities, except for Michael Jackson, of course, because I loved Michael Jackson as a child. But all of the people that were there, I didn't know until later that they were celebrities. I just, he just pumped people up so much that I thought everyone was important, equally as important, which they are, but equally famous, I guess, in that sense of the word important, because of the fact that he would just make such a big deal about people. So, but there was a lot of fun moments, daddy was always so theatrical, and his den where he used to hang out is where all the people would come and hang out. But yeah, I only got excited about Michael Jackson. Because Michael Jackson, maybe John Travolta, he was around a whole lot, but I wasn't excited about John Travolta. I didn't really know who John Travolta was at that age, except for my father talking about how good, well, he can dance. He would say, dance, John, dance. And he'd start dancing, and daddy would be clapping his hands. That's right, John, dance. And I remember him just dancing. So, you know, that's about all the memories that I would have with different people. But he would like Clint Eastwood to reenact his famous scenes, you know, Clint, go across the room and then turn around and tell me you got 2 days to get out of town. And he would go do it. So, you know, daddy was so playful. He's like a big kid. He liked, his favorite actor was Christopher Lee, Dracula. And he would have Christopher Lee act like Dracula, act like you're trying to attack me, Christopher, you know, so he would do it, you know, so he was a big kid, my father. So those are the memories. They were great. And yeah, I'm glad that I have them.
Yes, yes. Hey, and I do want to give a shout out to your husband, Kevin Casey. Definitely want to give him a shout out. You know, as I am a married man, my life doesn't revolve around anywhere unless it revolves around my wife first and then my kids. So I know that, you know, you're viewed as one. So we got to make sure we give love to Kevin.
That's very nice. Thank you. I'll tell him you said that. I appreciate that.
Well, I got my last segment. It's called Impulse Q&A. And pretty much I got some impulse questions. And I hopefully get some impulse answers from you. I wrote them down earlier. So.
Oh, God. Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah, no, I'm not that crazy. So don't worry. So you don't like the question, you could say pass, and that's totally fine. But I have another question for you. I want you to answer three questions.
Okay, let's hear it.
Here we go. Question number one. To make life easier, what is one thing you do every day that you wish was automated?
That's a good question. To make life easier, one thing that I do every day, I communicate with friends and family. That makes life easier for me. I don't know. But give me another question.
Question number one.
Okay.
What's your least favorite sweets?
My least what?
What's your least favorite sweets?
Oh God, I love all sweets. So let me see. My least favorite sweets would be healthy sweets like prunes. I love sweets. I got a sugar tooth. Okay, go on.
I recently found a vegan hype, and I didn't know that when you try vegan chocolate, like I had this place called Monty's, and it blew my mind. Once I had a milkshake with chocolate, and I was like, "That's not real chocolate," and I can't have it again. So. That's what led this question. Cause I was like, man, what is the other things out there that people don't like? Cause I don't like fake chocolate, carob chocolate. It's not good. But
Right. Me neither. Tell me.
What is one thing you recommend everyone tries at least once?
Write a book.
Ooh.
Everyone's got a book in them. A memoir. Write a memoir. Something. You got to write.
You just said, go ahead, get on the edge of the cliff, and you're going to jump like I jumped. And you know what? I hope you land the same way I land, with 600 pages underneath me.
Right, and on your feet. You'll do it. You can't fail if you try.
Yes. Question number three. If you are on an airplane for 10 hours, who are you riding with, and what are you guys talking about?
If I'm on an airplane for 10 hours, I am probably riding with someone I love, because I do not like to fly alone. And we are talking about how I do not have to worry because the plane's going to land safe. Because I do not like to fly. I don't like to fly. But no, for seriously, if I was going that far, it would probably be for something very important to do with something to do with my father. And there'd be somebody I'm close to flying with me. So we'd be talking about what it is we're probably going to get done. You can give me another question if you want, but that's the only thing I can think of at the top of my head, because I avoid airplanes when I can. And never fly alone. So, and usually I'm just like trying to sleep through because I don't like turbulence. So, okay.
No, you survived. You survived. You have survived my impulse Q&A. And as a reward.
Well, thank you.
Promote time. You know, let's promote the At Home with Muhammad Ali podcast, the book, At Home with Muhammad Ali, A Memoir of Love, Loss, and Forgiveness. You know, let's run that up. Let's run up the podcast when it comes out. You know, let's promote. Let's
right. Right. Get the audio book now if you want to listen instead of read. You want some entertainment? Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. So everybody then supports. And I will let you know now if you need any help with the podcast or you need an insight. If I can't answer it, I will.
I'll have you on for a guest. I'll ask you your favorite chapter. I'll learn. I'm just learning this whole podcast thing. So it's kind of fun. I'm excited.
Well, I'll tell you now, the way I do things is a little unique. It's different. It's something that, you know, the other guys don't do. But I had a situation where they were like, well, hey, if you're going to meet this format, I need for you to do segments. And so I added segments. And so I'm like, well, you know, at the end of this, I'm still going to do things my way. And if you notice, it's still different. I'm like, my viewers knows it's coming. I'm going to hit you with it. You got any questions for me?
No, I can text you and ask you, but I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't got nothing right now. I'll ask you. I'll probably call you and ask you, pick your brain about some things when I get down to my podcast, because it sounds like you're doing good. You know what you're doing. Thank you. You're welcome.
It's Contrast Uncut, season 4, episode 14. Man, big shout outs to Uncle Snoop's Army and Bobby D Presents. I appreciate you, brothers. I wouldn't be able to do incredibly dope shit like chop it up with Hannah Ali about her history and just, you know, grace some wonderful stories about her father and these books that she's been able to write and just tell so many great, great things about this man and his history and how much she influenced her and how much she's influencing the world now through his stories. And thank you, Hannah, for coming on the show. It's been an amazing time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. This is Hannah Ali, enjoying my time here on Contrast Uncut. Shout out to everybody, Bobby D, etc., who helped make this podcast possible. You guys are doing a great job. Oh, so when I was young, crisscross make them jump. Battle rap before respect, my nigga, this ain't what you want. Can I kick it when I'm rhyming? Be a legend through Ebonics, was a sticker boy. Felt like sticky.
Man, I know you guys can't smell this right now, and I ain't talking about none of that other stuff. I'm talking about some of that good stuff, that smell good stuff. I think it's breakfast. What time is it? It's breakfast time. Make sure you tune in to Contrast Uncut no matter what you're doing. Whether you're eating breakfast, you're smelling good food like I'm smelling, or if you're smelling other stuff, we're good to watch too. Make sure you tune in. Thank you.